You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 16th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, Kara, did you give up on Westworld, or are you plowing through still?
You know what? I gave up for a little while because I was just really not enjoying it. One episode, I just fell asleep halfway through, and I never do that.
That's impossible.
I know, but I decided to give it another shot. So I'm not caught up, but I am getting back into it and watched one of the older episodes, and I think probably within the next 2 weeks I'll be caught up.
No spoilers, but I'll just say that I'm up to date. And especially the most recent episode, it starts to get very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely, it's a little bit of a slow start, but it's worth the investment. The writing is good. It's definitely worth the investment. I think the problem that they had, because my wife, I think, is in the same boat that you are, where she kind of lost interest after the first couple episodes. The problem is that they gave you no reason to care about anything. You know?
Yeah, and that's problematic. I think they also, one of the things that I was struggling with is, without giving anything away, it kind of is a show on two levels. You know, there's the plot lines of the individual characters in the park, and then there's the deeper plot lines of, like, how does the park work and what are they all trying to figure out and is there any sort of, like, weird stuff happening behind the scenes? And to me, that's actually the plot of the show, but they spend so much time on the dumb Western stuff. You know, searching for this one dude, and then there's all the violence, and I just get bored by that side of it, and I would much rather get into the grit. And I think they're trying to balance the two, and I'd rather have more meat.
There may be some things in there that you're seeing now that either aren't interesting enough, but may make sense later.
Could be the case.
They're going to come back to some of these, you know, otherwise insignificant, might be insignificant details.
That's
or things
true.
You just don't care about now, and it will have a bigger role later.
Yeah, right? I think they had a lot to establish, you know, and I did.
That's
I think
true.
They didn't want to give too much away too soon, but that is really tricky to create the background for a complicated story with a lot of hidden plot lines, but giving people enough to drag them in. I think that they're doing a really good job overall, but they were slow at the beginning.
Yeah.
Maybe they were counting on people being really fascinated with just the superficial level of the show, but I think that we're just too sophisticated at this point in time. We've seen so many things like, okay, robots, Westworld, fine. You get over that very quickly.
I think a lot, and I don't want to speak for all women because I'm sure there are many women out there who are like really into Westerns, but I don't know if the top line plot really overtly appeals to women in
that
a general sense, you know? And so I just
Could
kind
be.
Of like, I don't care about Westerns. I don't care about all the sex and violence, and it's just not that interesting to me.
Weirdo.
Yeah, right.
Don't get that. Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins,
I don't know. There's something about him.
He's amazing.
What happens when Anthony Hopkins comes onto these scenes is that I move myself closer to the edge of my chair because I really want to know more about him, his character. He's so appealing in pretty much any role he does, and I think this is no exception. I really am enjoying him in this.
Not the engineers, but the workers. Like the ones who fix the bodies, I find them to be really just awful.
They're dull.
The
characters are dull, but I think
they're so dull.
You'll see. I think that's on purpose. Let me just say that's very deliberate.
Very deliberate.
All right.
I
good
believe.
To know. Good to know.
Yeah, it's hard to have your acting compared next to Anthony Hopkins,
exactly.
Yeah. But he's not in that much where he just is overshadowing everybody so much. And there are some good actors in there.
There's some great actors in there.
Oh yeah,
Ed Harris,
there's one bit.
Fantastic.
Yep. Oh yeah, one bit of criticism though that I kind of agreed with was that it's so good on so many levels. A lot of the acting, a lot of the writing, visually it's gorgeous. The technology, but sometimes I feel like the characters, you don't really care about the characters as much as you should.
When you look at some of the characters who are actually really amazingly acted, they had to establish that you aren't really supposed to care about them.
Yeah, but Everything changes.
I'm sure everything changes, but the expendability of some of it does kind of contribute to that disconnect that you have with the characters.
It's bottom line, to me, it seems worth the investment, and it's definitely taking off.
Oh, God, yeah. So, I can't wait for the new episodes.
All right, Bob, get us started with A Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Okay, this week I'm going to talk about Percy Lavon Julian, 1899 to 1975. He was a brilliant African-American research chemist and pioneer who rose to great career heights despite the obstacles, the many obstacles in his path. So as an African-American in the early 1900s, you can imagine, I'm sure, how difficult it could be to get higher education at university, for example. He couldn't stay in the dorms, and the off-campus boarding home refused to provide meals. After graduating as valedictorian from DePauw University and attending Harvard from a fellowship that he got, he had to withdraw because Harvard stopped him from being a teaching assistant because they were afraid it would cause resentment from the other students. It was terrible. After he finally got his degree, it was no better. He was refused a professorship at DePauw once they found out that he was black. So, but despite all of that and many, many more horrible things he experienced, he did amazing things. At Glidden, he was critical to the success of the Navy's firefighting foam that literally saved thousands and thousands of lives aboard ship. It was his other achievements, though, that really cemented his legacy. He invented a technique of synthesizing progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone from plants. Now, these hormones were clearly, this is the beginning of the ability to actually create these hormones and the recognition of just how important and helpful they could be. But they could only extract the tiny, tiny amount. They'd have to basically, get like animal spinal cords and kind of distill it from them. And they would just get these very, very small amounts. His method was able to create 100 pounds of these hormones every day. Huge leap in production capability. So this led, of course, to industrial scale production for many uses like hormonal deficiencies. He seemed to be able to do the same thing for much of the rest of his career. Pretty much whatever expensive chemical he focused on, he was able to devise a way to make it for orders of magnitude less than it was. Really had tremendous impact on these industries, which is actually pretty incredible considering that his house was firebombed twice after he moved in the 50s. This guy, it was just terrible. He actually, he and his son would like sit in a tree in front of his house with a shotgun waiting for people to try and blow up his house. So remember Percy Lavon Julian? Mention him to your Facebook friends, perhaps when commenting about neurosteroid active metabolites or even negative allosteric modulators.
Don't you love that name, Percy? It's so old school.
Oh, yeah.
Is it Percival? Yeah. Is it short for Percival?
I've only seen Percy.
Oh, interesting. Possibly. So he might actually have just been named Percy. You know, I have one of those weird old school middle names. It starts with an L. It's not that old school. It's more like 40s. Like Louise. 1940s.
Lorraine.
Louise, you got it. Yeah.
Louise. Easy.
Louise.
That's my mother's middle name.
It's so old.
No way. What's the odds?
Oh, my God.
That's a quadrillion to one.
So good news, everyone.
Yeah.
It's good to have
some finally
good news every now and then. I think we all
every now and then.
I know what you're going to say.
Last year, if you recall, both the FDA, that's the Food and Drug Administration, and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, announced that they were reviewing their regulation of homeopathy. Specifically, over-the-counter homeopathic products, not the practice of homeopathic medicine. That's regulated by the states. They had an open period where they were taking comments from the public, and then they had expert reviews and reviewed everything. And they've been reviewing everything for the last year. And now, finally, the FTC, not the FDA, but the FTC announced their conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty good. It's probably as good as we could have expected. So the FTC put out a press release further linking to their full statement. And then they also had another statement, which was essentially all of their a summary of all of their testimony, all the people who gave them comments. So a lot of information. But essentially they say, well, here, I'll read you from their their decision. The policy statement explains that the FTC will hold efficacy and safety claims for over-the-counter homeopathic drugs to the same standard as other products making similar claims. That is, companies must have competent and reliable scientific evidence for health-related claims, including claims that a product can treat specific conditions. The statement describes the type of scientific evidence that the commission requires of companies making such claims for their products. So basically, which is what we asked them to do, do your effing job, basically. And, you know, the only thing that makes sense is essentially both the FDA and the FTC were carving out exceptions for homeopathy. And all we really asked them to do was just eliminate the exceptions. Just regulate them like you would regulate anything else, according to your mandate, according to the actual law, and just stop these exceptions. And the FTC decided to do basically that. However, there's one caveat to this, because the FTC is not the FDA, right? They can't pull things from the market or whatever. They regulate the marketing, the commercializing of these products. So all they could really regulate are the claims that are being made for them. They said, now products can make claims that are not based upon strict scientific evidence, but you have to then say what the claims are based on. So they said, for example, if a manufacturer wants to put a health claim on a homeopathic product that is not sufficiently backed by scientific evidence, they would have to also say there is no scientific evidence that the product works, and the product's claims are based only on theories of homeopathy from the 1700s that are not accepted by most modern medical experts.
Does it actually say that?
That's that wording, something like that.
Or the equivalent of that. And they go into even more detail, basically saying that they will evaluate the label, and if they think that the net effect is that it's misleading, then they will declare that it's in violation of the FTC Act. So the disclaimer has to be as big and prominent as the claims, may even need to be incorporated into the claims, and you can't take the disclaimer away by immediately making more claims. So basically saying, don't even try to get around the intent of the law here. We are going to enforce the intent, which is you cannot deceive the consumer by making claims that are not backed by science.
And Steve, right. Also, another thing that made me very happy was that they will not allow like gushy celebrity endorsements either. Mm-hmm. Right? That was kind of big too.
Are there gushy celebrity endorsements right now for homeopathic products?
Well, any endorsements from anybody.
Yeah.
You know, testimonials.
You can always pay somebody.
And testimonials are huge for herbs and stuff that herbal supplements.
Pretty much all
they are huge. So to do away with that was very nice. So Steve, were you saying that they couldn't actually prevent these things from supplements to be, or these medicines?
They're drugs. They are classified as drugs in the United States, and they are marketed as drugs. So
they couldn't stop them from being sold. How far could they have gone?
Can't they just reclassify them as vitamins and then?
Who's they?
The people who are putting them on the shelves?
No. Let's back up a little bit. But before we get on to that, I just wanted to note that in their longer document where they summarize all of the testimony, they specifically mention the Society for Science-Based Medicine's comment. And also the Richard Dawkins Foundation and the Center for Inquiry and the Sense About Science all got a shout out.
Nice.
Yeah, but who was mentioned first?
The Society for Science-Based Medicine happened to have been mentioned first.
And
not that that's important, but they said they summarized what our point was, you know, that they don't work, which is basically it, and that this deceives consumers. So that was good. It's obviously very nice that, you know, we're getting vindication for a lot of the work that we do. You know, we made ourselves heard, and hopefully this had an influence. As well as they said a lot of individual people, you know, wrote in and expressed skepticism, and they summarized their views as well. So if you were like an individual who submitted a comment to the FTC, it had an effect. Then they also reviewed all of the industry feedback they got, which was just nonsense. You know, it was all, but people like it. And there are positive studies. Yeah. Okay. Sure. There's positive studies for everything. You know, so they want to
crap studies.
Yeah, they want to cherry pick only the positive studies, and they want to base it on authority and on anecdotes and, you know, popularity. There you
yeah,
go.
If we did that for everything, we would have nothing.
Bloodletting would
nothing,
bloodletting
nothing
would still
works.
Be, would still be
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and they can't counter our point, which is that there have been multiple systematic reviews looking at all the evidence, and they show that it can't possibly work, and it in fact does not work. And they cannot counter that because that's what the evidence shows. So they resort to their, but it's popular and people like it. Okay. So just to back up a little bit on the infrastructure, so the FDA regulates, you know, obviously food and drugs, and under drugs that includes things that are classified as drugs, which by definition are substances that treat or cure diseases. So the regulatory definition, this is not a scientific definition, the regulatory definition in the US of a drug is something that you that has a specific disease claim attached to it by definition. Supplements have supplement claims, which cannot mention diseases. They can only make structure function claims. So the homeopathic industry can't just decide what their products are. The, you know, Congress basically has decided what their products are. Homeopathic products are classified as drugs and regulated as drugs. But the FDA decided simply not to do that, even though the law says that they're supposed to do that. They decided that it wasn't worth it. You know, whatever, 40, 50 years ago, they said this is too fringe a market for us to expend any resources on. So we're just going to let the homeopathic industry tell us, you know, what their products are used for. So literally, all homeopaths have to do in order to have a homeopathic potion approved, you know, for a specific indication is write it down in their book, you know, their Materia Medica. That's it.
That's horrific.
But that's just a choice that the FDA made. That's not the law. Mm-hmm. So what we told the FDA was, all right, stop that. You know, just regulate them like the drugs that they are. Forget about carving out this exception for them. Just hold them to the same standard that the law requires, which is to, you know, you need adequate evidence of safety and efficacy before they can go on the market. Of course, if the FDA did that, again, we're still waiting to hear their decision, that could destroy the homeopathic, you know, over-the-counter market overnight, right? Or whenever they phase
in.
Yeah, whatever delay they put in there. So the question now is that we're all waiting for is what's the FDA going to do? Are they going to do their job? Are they going to try to find some wishy-washy middle ground, which is what I suspect? They're going to say, okay, we're going to tighten up the requirements for the labeling. Like you have, you know, they talked about making the dilutions in such a format that the average person will understand what they are, because nobody knows what 30C means. And having similar disclaimers like the FTC requires, so they'll probably do something like that. If they say, okay, we're going to no longer unilaterally exempt them, you know, from the law, or just accept, you know, the homeopath's word for it and actually regulate them according to the rules, no homeopathic product can provide evidence of efficacy because none of them work.
That's why I guess I still don't understand why they won't just rebrand everything as a supplement.
Because it would take an act of Congress literally to do that. The Congress would have to change the law. The FDA can't do it. Congress would have to.
It's not anything anyway. It's not an actual drug because there's nothing in the bottle.
Yeah, right. But because of that, this is the way the laws are written in the United States, that's how they are currently classified. If according to the law, something is a drug, you can't decide that it's a supplement. You know, once the FDA decides, all right, this is a drug and designates it a drug, and you can't put it in a product and say, well, I'm selling it as a supplement. You can't do that.
But how do they even decide that something is a drug if it's homeopathic? Because there's no active ingredient.
Because if it's written down in the Materia Medica, it's a homeopathic drug.
That's so crazy.
That's how they decide.
It seems like if you're trying to say that my diluted, it's arnica, why don't you just call it Flarnica? It's just water.
You can't do that either.
Oh, and just say, well, Flarnica is a supplement.
Flarnica.
That's the part I'm confused about. Like, how do you regulate like vapor?
I hear what you're saying, but the fact that's transparent. Obviously, it's already a thing. Even though it's fairy dust, and it's already, you know, exists as a thing within the regulatory scheme in the United States, and you can't just unilaterally decide that you're going to consider it something else. The FDA will go, nope, sorry, that's a homeopathic product. It's already written down right there. It's in the law, whatever. It's regulated like a drug. This is how we're going to regulate it. And the FDA can't change their own rules either. The FDA can't decide to regulate them as supplements. Again, they have to just follow the law. The FDA is a creature of the Congress, and only the Congress can change what the FDA can or cannot do. So that's the other thing. I think if the FDA decides to actually do their job, let's say, and to follow the law and to not exempt homeopathy, then I strongly suspect there'll be a big push for Congress to pass a law modifying the FDA and reclassifying homeopathy or carving out an exception for it or whatever.
Oh, boy.
And the good news is I don't think partisan politics will actually play into that.
Oh, yes, it will. Yeah,
but I don't see this movement as being a classically liberal or conservative movement. That's what I'm saying.
Well, it does straddle the aisles, and which is why it probably will happen. But definitely,
why I meant partisan. Yeah, like, the Republicans. That's what I meant by that phrase.
But they use different arguments. The Republicans are basically anti-regulation.
They're always trying
to hamstring the FDA, whereas the Democrats are more like just pro, you know, health freedom. You know,
yeah.
So the companies like this have a different story that they tell to each side of the aisle, but they get
that's
both
true.
Sides.
They have lobbyists
on
both sides. Yeah, that's why you bet they do. So hard,
right? Yep. Which is why it's tough because there's no science lobby. You know, that's not a big enough force in the Congress.
And the Congress has to be scientifically literate enough to understand these arguments.
Do they even really know what's going on?
So we'll see.
Or care.
So when I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine, I said so if and when the FDA makes their decision, and if it's big. If it like fundamentally changes the way over-the-counter homeopathic remedies are regulated in the United States, we have to expect an immediate industry backlash, which means that if we're going to keep that victory and keep it from backfiring, we're going to need to really mobilize. Like the entire skeptical movement is going to need to mobilize. We're going to need to write our, you know, representatives, our congressmen and senators, and make a big stink and really try to stay on top of the public conversation about it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, because you know they're going to be doing it. Be very easy for them to completely undo anything good that comes out of this.
Wouldn't that take a bit of an effort, though? I mean, to go against the FDA and the FTC?
All you need is 51 senators and, you know, a majority of congressmen.
Well, Steve, what if the FDA decision goes against the FTC decision, say for labeling? What if their guidelines are in, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. The FTC actually sent a public letter to the FDA saying, you guys should do this. You know, they actually are already calling out the FDA.
Hmm. Okay. So that's a good sign. Yeah. That's a good sign.
Yeah, they have to get their ass and their head wired together, basically, those two organizations. but we'll see. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I don't know what kind of turf war could come out of that, or if you have to meet the minimal requirements of both. You know, like they can't tell each other what to do, but within their purview, they you know, like the FTC can have a higher standard than the FDA, and there's nothing the FDA can do about that. You know what I mean? I think that's what it will come down to. You can't force the other side to lower their standards, but you could have a higher standard, and that kind of forces the issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, good idea.
We'll definitely have – this is good news overall. We'll have to keep on top of this. There may be a call to action coming at some point. You know, we have homeopathy on the ropes. We can't let it slip away. You know, we have to deliver the knockout punch if we have the opportunity to do that. I still think it's not likely, but we have to take these chances when they come and see what we can accomplish. You know, the fact that the FTC cited us in their decision shows that we can have an effect, even though our numbers are small. You know, I think our voices can be very, very powerful because we're freaking right. You know, it helps to have evidence and logic on your side, you know?
Yeah, it's not exactly a spectrum, this one. This one's pretty as close as certainty as you'll ever get.
Although you guys saw what was it, the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year, didn't you?
Huge.
Post-truth.
Post-truth.
Post-truth?
Post-truth,
yeah. We'll see.
It just means that, here it is. I just found it. Oxford Dictionaries. I'm going to read you the definition. Relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. AKA, in this era of post-truth politics, it's easy to cherry-pick data and come to whatever conclusion you desire.
Yep. Which has always been the case. It's just maybe a matter of magnitude. You know?
Yes, it's just trending right now. That's all.
It's trending. Yeah, I don't like it.
This year was definitely different in terms of the prevalence of post-truth, even though I never heard that term before. This year it went kind of crazy.
So we got to fight against post-truth ideology.
Pretty much since the beginning of my skeptical career, I have said that if there is anything that we should be able to get rid of, it's homeopathy, because it is 100% magic. You know, it really is. I mean, the most vulnerable pseudoscience out there, in my opinion. If we can't even put a stake through that one, then there's no hope. But whatever, we'll see. Huh. Okay, Evan. This is actually, you know, in a way, a little bit of another kind of victory. We have an update on the Stern Laboratories.
Yes, sort of a victory, I suppose you could say. Their energy kind of ran out, as reported by the Business Post, which is an Irish newspaper, available in print and online. The infamous company Stern has announced that they've laid off their staff and are liquidating their assets, winding up the company. The end. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stern is an Irish company, or was an Irish company, that had been promising, which is running on 10 years now, and 23 million euros later, that they had pioneered what amounted to essentially free energy devices. It was just last year when we talked about their latest and greatest products, which were made available for pre-order. The O-Cube, which was a USB charging device for 1,200 euros. That's a bargain. And something called the O-Phone, a cell phone that never had to be charged. Or apparently built, because neither of these products made it to market, and now the company is gone. So here's a little bit of history about Stern. In August of 2006, if you'll remember, they announced that they had developed a technology which provided free, clean, and constant energy, which, as the rest of the rational world knows, is in violation of the law of conservation of energy, a fundamental principle of physics. In an interview at the time that they made this announcement, Stern founder and CEO Sean McCarthy said, and I quote, "There has never been an identifiable source for the energy. What this technology is doing is directly contradicting the basic laws of physics, the law of conservation of energy. So therefore, Stern challenged the scientific community to investigate their claim." And in December of 2006, they said that they had selected a jury of scientists to do so. So for a few years, this jury of scientists went at it and had a look at the claims and the devices and everything else. What was their finding? Well, here was their official conclusion. 22 independent scientists and engineers were selected by Stern to form this jury. It has for the past 2 years examined evidence presented by the company. The unanimous verdict of the jury is that Stern's attempts to demonstrate the claim have not shown the production of energy. The jury is therefore ceasing work.
Wah, wah, wah.
At the time, famous skeptic and host of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe was quoted as saying, Stephen Novella, "So far, that's how every single free energy claim has ended, without free energy. The story is more predictable than murder," she wrote. Now,
that's very timely.
I find that insulting to murder, she wrote.
That's kind of an inside joke, because my wife Jocelyn loved that show and I hated it, because it was so, like, halfway through the show, like, they reveal who the murderer is, because they, like, do a close-up on her, and she, like, gives this curious look. It's like, it, you know, it's like for children, you know? Anyway.
I guess there was something intriguing about it, I suppose. Angela Lansbury, right?
Yeah,
she's a doll.
Stern had given two public demonstrations of their technology. The first one was in July 2007. At the Connecticut Museum in London, but the device failed to work, which I don't think really constitutes a demonstration, right. Or maybe it does, you know, and special pleading galore followed. In a blog post titled Perpetual Idiocy, also by Stephen Novella, he said that, "I am shocked that the demonstration did not occur. I have to say that overheating from camera lights is an extremely lame excuse, but not atypical." Yep, that was their excuse. They couldn't make, the conditions were not right because camera lights were causing some sort of interference.
Right. So apparently you can stretch this out for 10 years and 23 million euros on abject failure and lame excuses. That's amazing.
There are other companies like Stern out there doing the exact same thing. And, you know, when you start investing in these things, it would be help to do a little bit of research to see what these kinds of companies are claiming, because you'll find out they all say the same thing. They all make the same promises and the results are all the same. 100% negative.
But they think that, if one of these things hits, you know, if it does hit, then we're billionaires, you know. So they're playing the lottery, although they don't realize that their probability of winning is actually zero, not only indistinguishable from zero, it's actually zero.
Right.
The reports now, the only discussion is this a con, or was he a self-deluded idiot? And I guess we don't know. The only thing they say is
the jury's still out. Yeah.
They say that, you know, it appears that they actually spent the 23 million euros on the company. So he wasn't like pocketing it or stashing it away in the Cayman Islands or something. But okay.
Doesn't mean he's not a con. I mean, just because he didn't like go to Vegas and blow a lot of money doesn't mean that he wasn't like into like the whole idea of just duping people.
Right. And he lived well for 10 years. You know, that's pretty good.
He did. Yep.
Yeah. He probably had a decent salary.
What's he going to do now, Evan?
Well, yeah. So according to the article, McCarthy has moved on to a career as a professional online poker player.
Oh my God. That's hilarious.
In which he will try to bluff even more people just at a poker table or at a computer, at a virtual poker table instead of investors from around the world. So some people think we've not heard the end of Sean McCarthy and his wacky ideas and inventions, but who knows? We will see.
The public has a short memory. These people never go away. What's his name came back? You know, that faith healer who Randy caught red-handed with a radio in his ear. I mean, if that guy could come back,
Peter Popoff.
I mean, yeah. What the hell?
He sells a product, Miracle Water.
Yeah.
Water that's been blessed by the saints of Whereverville. And it's, you know, guaranteed to, I don't know, cleanse your soul in some
guaranteed
way.
Guaranteed to hydrate.
That's right.
No, Evan.
One tenth your money back.
Evan, they're like smart pills. Remember that old joke? The smart pills?
The smart pills?
Yeah. Guy ate the smart pills and he said, wait, these taste like rabbit shit. See, you're getting smarter already. All right.
Good one.
Let's move on. Okay. So now this is not so good news. Kara,
what a horrible transition. I don't want
CDC,
to go
The CDC is warning us about STDs ASAP.
PDQ.
Tell what's going on here.
QRSTUV.
WTF.
Keep it on the
yeah. TLDR. Sorry, guys.
Right. Yeah.
You know what TLDR is, right?
TLDR.
Too late to drive the rabbit.
Oh, you guys are. Come on, we got to work on our social media literacy.
I know this.
I used to know that.
Of course. Wait.
Too long. Didn't read.
Oh yes. I've come across
which,
that.
I will be honest, of the 176-page report by the CDC, I didn't really read every word.
Oh, Kara.
But I have some, I know, I have some top line info. And it is rough, but honestly, I don't think this is quite as alarming as it seems. So let's see.
In all seriousness, was there an executive summary? Because that's usually what I read.
If there's
like 200-page whatever report, I go right to the executive summary.
Yeah, there's like an intro and then they just break it down by disease. So you can look at all of the graphics and that helps. But if you want to find actual numbers, you have to kind of go into the text and dig that out. Yep. So mainly the CDC report, and we remember Centers for Disease Control is, it's an American institution. So we're actually looking here at American statistics on sexually transmitted diseases, which, Steve, you're a doctor. Mm-hmm. I thought they were called STIs now.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, but why are they calling them STDs throughout this whole report? It's
because
weird.
Because it doesn't freaking matter. That's why.
Yeah, because it's the same thing. It's global warming and climate change.
Yeah, whatever.
It means the same thing. Okay, so they mostly focused on chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. And sort of the big take home of this is that those three common STDs reached a combined 20-year high, which is a bummer. But honestly, if you break down why that is, I think we're seeing some trends that aren't as scary and a couple trends that are not looking good. So in the US alone, there are 1.5 million reported cases of chlamydia in 2015. 400,000 diagnoses of gonorrhea. And syphilis, which I think most people know is the least common, had just under 24,000 cases, but that was still up 18% among men and 27% among women versus the 2014 totals. So if we look at a breakdown of all three sort of over a 20-year span, what gives me hope is that gonorrhea actually dipped quite a lot, but only really from 1984 until around 1996, and then it just sort of leveled off. Now, the reason I'm extra worried about gonorrhea is because it's incredibly antibiotic resistant. And that one kind of gives me the most heart palpitations. Chlamydia is shooting up. Like, we're seeing a steady increase in chlamydia, which is also very worrisome. Syphilis is just sort of hanging out at a low level. The bummer thing about syphilis is that it still happens at all because it was almost eradicated after the war. Like, I think a lot of public health campaigns did a really good job of helping people understand the danger of syphilis. Syphilis obviously has incredibly detrimental long-term effects if it goes untreated.
Just ask Hitler.
Yeah, it's a huge bummer.
Which is very rare. It's very, very rare. Yeah. I think in my whole career, I've seen one case.
Yeah, because look, only 24,000 people are diagnosed with syphilis.
Well, let me say that. I've seen two cases. I saw one case that was just a straight up syphilis that led to, it was in like at the time the patient was like 90 and she had it like 40 years ago. The other case was in a patient who had HIV. And the syphilis transformed into neurosyphilis very, very quickly because they had HIV.
Because they were immunosuppressed.
And that's how we diagnosed them with HIV. This is also was in the 90s, so this was before modern treatment of HIV.
It's, you know, when you go – have you guys ever been to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia?
No.
At the College of Physicians? Oh, it's awesome.
No.
It's like a museum of medical oddities. It's fascinating. And they have a big wall of skulls, and there are quite a few syphilitic skulls. So you can really see, you know, how damaging the disease used to be. Yeah, very, very rare now. So the most at-risk groups – across the board seem to be young adults and teenagers, women and gay and bisexual men. And sort of the consensus of this big report by the CDC is that these groups just seem to not be receiving adequate preventive health care. So they kind of talked a lot about these three STDs, but as we know, there are a lot of other STDs out there. So there's a little bit of discussion about each of them, and I wanted to kind of go over that. The first one is called chancroid, C-H-A-N-C-R-O-I-D. It's caused by the bacterium Haemophilus ducreyi.
Okay.
And
chancroid.
Maybe chancroid, yeah. And it affected, in 2015, 11 people. So it's incredibly,
not many.
Exceedingly rare. But it also causes things that sound like they happened last century, like genital ulcers and inguinal lymphadenopathy, or
inguinal lymphadenopathy.
Lymphadenopathy, or buboes. Is that how you pronounce that? Buboes? B-U-B-O-E-S? Very rare, though. A total of 11 cases. I would say probably we don't want to worry about that one too much. But they are saying it's very, very difficult to culture and it's very difficult to diagnose. It's probably underdiagnosed, but still 11 cases. That's not at the top of the like Concernicus list. HPV, however, is incredibly common. HPV, human papillomavirus, is unfortunately not a reported condition. So this is why the CDC actually didn't include in their full report pelvic inflammatory disease, herpes simplex virus, trichomonas vaginalis, or HPV, because these don't have any national reporting standards. So it's very complicated to try and figure out how many cases. A lot of times they figure out how many cases based on how many doctors report that individuals first came to their office seeking a test or a diagnosis. Now, that's a terrible way to figure out how many cases of HPV there are, because most people don't know they have HPV until they get a pap. And a lot of men don't even know they're carrying HPV. It's very rare that men are tested for HPV. There is some information about vaccine coverage. The goal was that by 2020, 80% of you know, young people, individuals within the vaccine range would be covered. But in 2015, only about 63% of girls aged 13 to 17 had received at least one dose, and only 42% had received all three doses. But I think that's still a really good sign. I mean, I think we're trending in the right direction yeah. with that. It's obviously lower among boys. 53% had received one dose and only 28% had received all three doses.
Yeah, we got to get those numbers up.
Yeah, and that's just one of, I think, those bummer things where, like, unless boys have genital warts, they don't know they're carrying the infection because it has so many more potential outcomes in women because it can lead to cervical cancer, but boys don't have cervixes. Herpes simplex virus is probably the second most common sexually mm-hmm. transmitted disease. So starting with HPV, very, very common. Herpes simplex virus, also very common. It's also not nationally reported. So there is some statistical analysis, mostly breaking it down by ethnic divides, but very, very common, something that everybody should be aware of, something that we should be tested for if we have a concern of contact or infection. And then the last one that they describe is Trichomonas vaginalis, which is also pretty common, and that's protozoal infection.
Mm-hmm.
But across the board, this survey mostly focused on syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. So we saw those trends there. They are trending up as a whole, but I think once you break them down, you actually see that gonorrhea and syphilis are holding pretty steady, and it's chlamydia that's sort of really on the rise. One thing to remember, though, is that in total, in the U.S., there are more than 110 million people, if you pick any point in time, who have a sexually transmitted disease, and there are about 20 million new infections every single year.
Yikes, that's a third of the population.
Isn't that crazy?
Whoa.
Yeah.
It's off the charts almost.
It's off the charts, yep.
I understand from firsthand reports that it's running rampant in college campuses.
Yep.
Which is, you know, not unexpected.
Well, it's not unexpected. And also not new, I don't think. But the annoying thing, I guess, is that we think of kind of millennials who are in college now as being more educated about these things.
Yeah.
As being more aware and kind of understand. It's not like this is the post-70s anymore. I think the fear of God was put into a lot of people. My whole time I was growing up, I had the sex education was basically like, you're going to get a disease. And so it's like, oh, God, you wear a condom.
Scare you into doing nothing.
Totally.
Well, I think HIV did have the effect of reducing other STDs because mm-hmm. people were protecting themselves so they don't get HIV. And so that reduced other diseases. And maybe we're after that now. Maybe the fear of HIV, because it's so treatable now, has diminished. And therefore, we're starting to see a resurgence to more pre-HIV levels, you know, mm-hmm. of STDs.
Yep. Wear a condom, people. Come on.
Yeah, no kidding.
Come on. Come on.
Get with the 90s.
Get tested. Ask your partner.
Yeah, ask your partner if you have, you know, if you have any, if you think you might possibly have any symptoms, get it checked out before you sleep with somebody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a problem. It's all obviously in the incubation period. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses.
Guys, you've heard us say it before, and we're going to say it again. We are big fans of The Great Courses Plus. And for good reason, there are so many wonderful courses in so many different disciplines that you can watch and continue to learn every day.
Yeah, we've been watching Higgs Boson and Beyond by our friend Sean Carroll. Yeah. Excellent series of lectures. I particularly like just the second lecture explains what fields are.
Ooh.
I know I've mentioned before on the show that that's a critical concept. And Sean makes the point that in popularizing physics, nobody talks about fields. Mm-hmm. But in physics courses, fields are everything. And it gives you a good idea what a field is, why light is you know, a disturbance in an electromagnetic field, why gravity is a field, why there aren't even really particles. They're just fields. Very critical to understanding physics at a deeper level, more than you will get with really any popular treatment of it.
The Great Courses Plus is offering you to watch as many courses as you want for free for an entire month. That's hundreds of courses on all sorts of topics: physics, biology, psychology, history, politics, photography, and more.
So guys, with the Great Courses Plus, watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, from your mobile device, tablet, laptop, TV, tricorder, whatever. Sign up today to get 1 month free as one of our listeners. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. All right, Bob. Well, this is actually a relevant news item. We're on a quest to find new antibiotics to treat all those STDs.
Ha, you are correct. So researchers and engineers at the Rockefeller University have used a new and powerful method to find antibiotics, and they've already had promising results without culturing a single microbial cell. So we've talked many times about how we're running headlong into a post-antibiotic era, where something as benign as a scratch should make you very, very nervous. Luckily, the past 5 to 10 years, we've seen lots of disparate research efforts that are trying to accelerate antibiotic discovery by sidestepping the current method's drawbacks. So typically today, if you want to find a new antibiotic, you will have to basically culture microorganisms in the lab. For example, you would find some harmless soil bacteria that happen to produce a natural antibiotic against the nasty disease-causing bacteria, and that's a very common way that you would do that. The problem is, though, only 1% of these microorganisms can actually be cultured in a lab. 1%.
We talked about that, I think it was a year ago or so, something like that, where there was they had developed a way of culturing a lot more soil bacteria. And that was important because it would help develop antibiotics.
Absolutely. Wow. Robert Austin, a physicist at Princeton University who actually studies microbial evolution, said the bacteriology community needs to get away from culturing bacteria on agar plates because this will not lead to new antibiotics. Now, an agar plate is essentially a petri dish that has food or agar with some nutrients inside, and that's what they use to grow. And this is exactly what these researchers in this latest news item did. They started by going through public databases for bacterial genomic data for, and these are bacterial genomes that typically infest the human body, or not necessarily infest, but that are found in the human body. Then they use very special software to identify groupings of genes within that database that had a good probability of creating molecules that could act as an antibiotic. And this software is so cool. It could predict what chemical structures the genes should make just on the code. Just on the base pairs. It's telling you this is what this stuff should create. So using this method, they found about 57 promising candidates, and from that 57, they identified 30 of them that were the most promising. So they created 25 different compounds, all without culturing any bacteria at all. They just made this stuff just from the genetic code in those databases. So these 25 compounds then were tested against human pathogens, and two antibiotics popped out as especially interesting. These are humamycin A and humamycin B.
Ooh.
I think that's how you pronounce it. So both humamycins come from a bacteria called Rhodococcus. And a Rhodococcus has been studied before, and it's never produced anything like they're seeing with this humamycin in the petri dish. And this shows, of course, another weakness of culturing bacteria in a lab. Even if you have one of the lucky 1% of bacteria that play nice in an agar plate and actually produce stuff that you could test, there's no guarantee it's going to actually produce an antibiotic that it actually has the genes to make. If those genes are silenced, you're screwed and you would never know. It's like, oh, this bacteria isn't producing anything. But little would you know that hidden in their genetic code could be this amazing ability to create fantastic antibiotics, but they're silenced. You're never going to see them. This database search could potentially find it. So they speculate that they work by screwing with the specific enzymes that build the cell walls. So it would kind of be like dissolving the mortar a bricklayer uses when, while he's trying to build the chimney. You're just not going to build that chimney. It's just going to fall down every time. So the bacterial cell dies. So in the future, I the hope is that we'll definitely see more researchers relying on this gene mining to find antibiotics. And they also have great hopes for other bacterial booty once they look at other bacteria that, that don't infect us or ones that haven't even been sequenced yet, because there's plenty that we haven't sequenced. So this is very promising news for the ability to discover new antibiotics that, that kind of go beyond the, you know, the problems we have with our current methods. And who knows, it could be an explosion of potentially new antibiotics that are found this way. You know, perhaps some amazing things. They might just find some incredible genes that, that produce the best antibiotics we've ever seen. Who knows? I think it's a great strategy. I hope they keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, even one new solid antibiotic that has a novel mechanism and no resistance would be huge. All right, Kara, it's time for What's the Word?
Yay. So the word this week was recommended by Etai in Los Angeles. Notice how I said that with a big question mark on the back. E-T-A-I. You think that's Etai? Maybe?
I think it's extraterrestrial artificial intelligence.
Maybe it is.
That, that sounds good, Kara. I think you pronounced it properly.
All right. All right. So the word this week is isotropic. And it was actually recommended because we talked about this in a science or fiction a few weeks ago, but we didn't actually use the term. So for something to be isotropic, it looks the same in all directions. It's invariant with respect to direction. It has equal properties and values along all physical axes. It's actually in contrast to things that are anisotropic, which means that there's a different physical value when they're measured in different directions. A good example of that would be wood. Wood is generally stronger along the grain than against the grain. So that would be anisotropic. Isotropy is actually one of the two underlying assumptions of the cosmological principle, which states that the observable universe has no preferred direction. The other principle, of course, is homogeneity, meaning that the universe is the same everywhere with no preferred origin. So I can see how those two things might get confused, isotropy and homogeneity. So to keep them straight, think of a world that's made up of just a flat land, perfectly round, flat land, with one big mountain on it that's perfectly symmetrical. If you were standing on top of the mountain, from your vantage point, the universe would be isotropic. It would look the same in all directions. It would have similar steepness to the mountain. The colors of things would be similar. It would be isotropic, but it would not be homogeneous because there's a giant mountain underneath you. So it's a good way to keep them straight. Or maybe it's not so good a way, but but it is an example nonetheless. Isotropy is based on the Greek root words iso, which we hear a lot as a prefix. That means the same or equal. And tropikos, meaning belonging to a turning. That actually came from the root tropos, which is also Greek, which is a turning away or a manner. So it's kind of the same way in every way. And the term was first introduced into the science literature in 1856.
In your example of standing on top of the mountain, does isotropy, can that be from a particular vantage point only? Because if you were not on the mountain, it would not be isotropic.
I think so, because if you're saying that something looks the same and is measurably the same in all directions, you have to be in a specific vantage point. And I think that's one of the really cool things about the cosmologic principle, is that you could be in this part of this galaxy, or you could be in a totally different place in space-time. And if you look around, it's supposed to look the same in all directions. So I
right,
do think
we have no option but to look at the universe from the vantage point of Earth.
Exactly, yeah. But I do think that it is vantage point respective when we're talking about direction. Although generally, when we're talking about physical principles outside of kind of the I don't want to say the mind F that is the cosmological principle. We're often just talking about measurements. You know, if you're looking at, to take a simple example, a polygon, and you were to measure all of its axes, it would be isotropic if all of the axes were the same length. So in that case, your vantage point is beyond what you're actually measuring.
Yeah. So if you're talking about an object, like would you say a sphere is isotropic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same in all directions. And it's homogeneous, technically, unless it's a sphere that has like chocolate chips in it.
But that is not a sphere.
But it's hard, right? It's actually hard to talk about something that is isotropic but not homogeneous, or something that is homogeneous but not isotropic. So, so it's almost like if it's isotropic, you have to be able to do like a 360 degree turn, look up, look down, measure everything in all directions, and it's all the same. Light is often isotropic. We think of it as being that way. It scatters in all directions. But for something to be homogeneous, but for it to also not be homogeneous, that's a difficult thing to conceptualize. So maybe in that case, you know, it has to be different below you or above you, but still the same in all directions. It's complicated. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to do one email. This email has to do with p-hacking. So, of course, I couldn't resist it. It's one of my favorite topics. This comes from Heath Bonner from Arlington, Texas. And Heath writes, on the 10-8 SGU podcast, you mentioned the concept of p-hacking in the context of power poses. I don't know if I understand the p-hacking concept well. My question centers around research connected to my work. I'm in the process of launching one of the injectable PCSK9 inhibitors in the cardiometabolic world. Amgen has one of the products, and Regeneron Sanofi Aventis has the other one. Both organizations have initiated large prospective outcome trials with about a total of 45,000 patients between them. However, there has been talk that if there is a clear benefit signal early in the trial, that the FDA may be okay with that and allow that outcomes data to be published and change the product label. We may follow the patients after that point, but the FDA and the manufacturers would get what they feel they needed from the trial data. Anyway, if the FDA calls the trial a success and allows us to proclaim we have a clear benefit earlier than the actual endpoint of the trial, does that constitute p-hacking?
Huh.
All right, it's kind of a complicated question, but what do you guys think about that? Does that p-hacking, if you stop a trial early because you have achieved a statistical significance before the endpoint?
Well, in a way,
by definition,
In a way, you want to fulfill what your hypothesis was, but your hypothesis should still be based on some observations. I remember when I was taking a stats class, a biostats class. So I asked my professor, how do I know if my sample size is big enough? And he was like, it depends on what you're measuring. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, if you're trying to figure out how many arms do people have, it doesn't take asking that many people how many arms they have before you realize that most people have two arms. And so there is, I think, something to be said about observational information first to help you determine how big your sample size should be. But if 45,000, is that what he said, 45,000?
Yeah.
Is an agreed upon sample size? Yeah. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, Steve. You can't just stop early.
Well, Heath, part of Heath's question also is that if there is a clear benefit signal early in the trial, I guess, do you predetermine what is a clear benefit signal? Do you have to sort of declare that ahead of time in order for it to be legitimate to stop the trial at that point?
I would hope so.
Yeah. So the answer is it depends. depends on how you do it. So to answer your question, which is kind of a side point, is how do you know how big a trial you need to have or what your sample size needs to be? That depends on your effect size, what effect size you think you're going to have. The bigger the effect size, the smaller number of subjects you can have. So the more subjects you have, the smaller the effect size that you will be able to detect to statistical significance. So you make some estimate about what you think the effect size is going to be, and then you calculate how many subjects do you need to see an effect of that size. Now, if the effect size is bigger, you may get to statistical significance early. That's basically what they're saying. Bigger than what you thought going in. But this is the thing. If what you're doing is simply collecting data, counting the data as you go, and then if at any point you cross over a p-value of 0.05, then you say, okay, we're going to stop here and declare this statistically significant. That is absolutely p-hacking. P-hacking basically means that you're making decisions as you go or after you see data in order to increase the probability of getting to statistical significance. The reason why that's not legitimate is because the statistics break down if you do that. The statistics are based on making all the decisions ahead of time. Mm-hmm. If you're stopping whenever you want, whenever the data becomes significant, you're increasing the probability that there will be some point in time across the collection of data where you happen to wander over statistical significance. If you predetermine the endpoint, then the statistics are legitimate, you know?
So ostensibly, stopping as soon as you reach significance in this trial, let's say you reach significance with 10,000 people and stopping early, seems like p-hacking, but what if it's significant from the beginning? Like, it's just a clear effect size, no matter how much more data you collect.
Right. So that's why it depends, is that it's okay to monitor a trial and to look for significance either in a beneficial effect early, or they also monitor trials to make sure people aren't dropping dead so that they'll stop, you know, if there's a negative
outcome.
Yeah, it works both ways. But the statisticians, if they're doing their job, they should do the calculations ahead of time. In other words, they might stop the trial early, not just because it happened to wander over statistical significance, but because they say, all right, if we get to this really big effect early on, we can stop the trial. Another way to think of it is that you might get to the point where the data is so robust that even if all subsequent subjects are negative, it will still be statistically significant, right?
Yeah.
So there's no point in going further. The outcome is now clear. Right. It will be statistically significant. So
it's kind of like calling an election, even though all of the ballots aren't in, because the split is so big that it doesn't matter if you counted the other ballots.
Right, exactly.
Right. Worst case scenario, it doesn't change anything.
Yes, exactly. A nice painful reminder. Thanks, Carol.
I just wanted to keep it topical.
Yeah. and of course, they're doing that because they're trying to save resources, because, you know, hell, after 20,000, you're pretty damn sure that this thing works. You know, you don't have to enroll another 25,000 subjects. That's a huge savings. It's also time. It also gets the drug to the people earlier. You might save a couple of years, you know, on getting that drug to market.
And there's an ethical consideration there, especially if it's the only thing available to these people.
Right. Yeah. Because once you know it's working, then what's the point of subjecting more people to maybe get a placebo? You know,
it would be unethical to not let it.
Exactly. Right. So. And that's basically when the FDA does that. When it gets to the point that it would be unethical not to stop the trial early, because we have a clear cut answer that's not just p-hacking, but that is showing a big effect that is already taking into account the fact that you're stopping the trial early, if that makes sense. So it all depends on how you do it. And it's all up to the statisticians to make sure that they're making the proper adjustments. Like, for example, let me give you another example. It's, if you make multiple comparisons, that could be p-hacking, right? If you say, okay, we're going to follow 10 endpoints, and if any one of them is statistically significant, we're going to call the trial positive. Okay. But that was 10 rolls of the dice. And so you have to adjust the statistics to account for the fact that you rolled the dice 10 times, right? The easy way to understand that is, if you're setting your p-value at 0.05 so that you basically there's a 1 in 20 chance that you'll reach significance, then, and it's not literally true, but we'll just say for simplicity that that's the case, then if you looked at 20 things, chances are pretty good that one of them will be significant. Right. But clearly that's cheating, right? So it should be obvious that one thing is not really significant. It's just that you looked at 20 things and had a 1 in 20 chance that any of them would be significant. But you can just adjust the statistics to account for the fact that you looked at 20 things. And then, of course, they would no longer be significant unless there was, you know, a much bigger statistical effect there. Does that make sense?
To me, it does.
Yeah, so it's p-hacking if you don't do the statistics right. If you're doing the statistics as if you've made all these decisions ahead of time, you have a predetermined endpoint, you're making one comparison, and that's it. You know, but you're not doing that. If you're doing the statistics as if you're doing it that way, but then you're making multiple comparisons or you're checking the data early or whatever, that's p-hacking. You just have the statistical analysis has to match the methods that you're using. So in the case of Heath's trial, you know, if the FDA is involved and everything, they usually know what they're doing. You know, they're not going to let them get away with p-hacking. So I'm sure that the statistics will be legitimate. But, you know, that's good to know the subtleties there of why, you know, so when you're looking at trials, because sometimes, you know, the statistics aren't legitimate. You know, the most common one that you will encounter is not controlling for multiple comparisons. You know, they looked at five or six outcomes, and sometimes they, you know, the other thing is they may have looked at more than what they've disclosed in the write-up. You know, they may have looked at 20. They only are telling you about five.
That's why there's a different, like, that's why in multivariate statistics, yeah. Like, there's models built in for that. Because I've seen that. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's a simple mistake. An undergrad will do it, and they'll do, like, 50 t-tests, you know? And then they'll be like, oh, five of them were significant. And it's like, yeah, that just happens by chance. Yeah,
right.
I mean, sometimes, you know, over the years, certainly caught pharmaceutical companies doing this on their own, you know, not for often, like when they do head-to-head trials. Now, they're not going for FDA approval. They already have FDA approval, but they're trying to show that their drug is better than a competitor's drug. Then they're a little bit – they're not under the eye of the FDA anymore. You know what I mean? Because they already have approval. Now it's just marketing research. Now they're just trying to show, hey, we're better than our competitor. Then they pull all of these tricks out of the bag. You know, we looked at 40 subgroups and two of them did better on our drug than our competitor's drug. Yeah, that's worthless. That's meaningless. That's noise, you know.
Noise.
Please. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they do that. They will do that.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, just three regular news items. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Bob is.
Item number one. By studying an owl's wing, engineers have designed an attachment that can reduce the noise generated by existing wind turbines by 10 decibels. Item number two, researchers have demonstrated an ultra-long-lasting oral drug delivery mechanism that can last for 14 days on a single dose. And item number three, astronomers have discovered for the first time a star that is not detectably rotating. Jay, you've been unusually silent this whole episode, so I'm going to make you go first.
All right, I will do it. They studied an owl's wing. And and they found a way to reduce the existing wind turbines by 10 decibels. Well, all right. I used to read about the way that feathers worked and they cut through the air. I know there's things about an owl's wing that makes it so it's exceptionally silent. I don't remember what it was, but I would say, okay. I mean, that's how we do this. That's science. We're studying something and applying what we learned to other things. You just would think it would be hard to translate like something soft like a feather to something incredibly rigid like a huge wind turbine blade. But I will say okay on that one. That's probably true. The second one here, researchers that they demonstrated the ultra long lasting oral drug delivery mechanism that can last for 14 days on a single dose. Would you mind clarifying that, Steve? They're taking a drug orally.
Yeah, so you're taking one pill. And that one pill is releasing drug for 2 weeks, for 14 days.
Oh, wow. I doubt that the pill is attaching itself because that would seem very odd and maybe dangerous to the tissue that it attaches to. But the pill itself is releasing, you know, is in your system for 14 days somehow. Oh, man, how would that happen? What is the goddamn mechanism? I mean, that's great. All right, I like that one. That one's just on the edge. This one about the astronomers discovered for the first time a star that is not detectably rotating. That's the key word there, detectably. That's interesting. Can a planet or a star exist without rotating? God, I just don't think so. I don't know. I really don't know. Phil Plait, where the hell are you? All right, so between two and three, I'm going to say that I'm going out on a limb here. I'm going to say that astronomers did not discover a star that's not rotating.
Okay, Kara.
By studying an owl's wing, engineers have designed an attachment that can reduce the noise generated by existing wind turbines by 10 decibels. I think the thing that's getting me about this one, I'm stressing out over my lack of knowing how loud certain things are, because I think decibels are logarithmic. So I feel like a difference in 10 decibels is an awful lot. And that is sticking out to me. But I'm assuming wind turbines are crazy loud and there's a chance for them to be crazy quiet. The ultra long lasting oral drug delivery mechanism. Maybe this is a material science thing and it, you know, attaches somewhere within your digestive tract, or it's like a special shape that prevents it from dislodging, or that makes it dislodge like in a time release. I don't know. And then the first time a star that's not detectably rotating. I like the word detectably, because that could mean that it is rotating and we just haven't.
No, so let me clarify that. When I say it's not detectably rotating, I don't mean that we don't know if it's rotating or not. I mean that if it is rotating, it's too slow for us to detect.
I see.
Yeah. It's not just that we can't measure it. It's that we're measuring. It's like, wow, it's rotating slower than our ability to measure.
That's weird. How do things not have a spin? Does anything not have a spin? Does a comet spin? No, but that's way smaller than a star. Oh, I suck at astronomy. All of these seem like they could be fact or fiction. I'm going to say the 10 decibels is fiction, which is... I'm going to regret saying it, but I'm going to say, yeah, that the wind turbine thing's fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Owl's wing, reducing the noise generated by 10 decibels. I think for some of the reasons that Jay said, I think this one will turn out to be science. Owls are relatively quiet when it comes to wind noise, I recall from a way back when. So sure, that can translate into better engineering designs such as turbines. No problem. The next one, ultra long-lasting oral drug mechanism lasting for 14 days on a single dose. I also think that this one's going to be science. Doesn't have to do with the coding on the drug that dictates the release. So they came up with a special coding of some sort that got them 14 days instead of the usual, I don't know, an hour, 24 hours maybe is for some drugs. So it's a lot longer, but I think it's possible. Therefore, that leaves the star not detectably rotating. Kara, what you said, I thought, also initially, but then Steve clarified it. But I still have a feeling that this one's going to turn out to be the fiction. There's something else going on with this star that they've detected. But we don't know what that is, but Steve will let us know in a minute. So the star rotation, that's fiction.
And Bob.
Yeah, for the owl's wing, yeah, Jay must have read my mind on this. Yeah, I remember a long time ago reading and watching documentaries on owls. One of the reasons why they're so successful is because the leading edge of their wings are different than most other birds. It's designed in such a way that it makes it incredibly silent. So you don't even know that thing's near you. And next thing you know, you're down its gullet. So I could absolutely, it's like a no brainer to think that they could put that idea into the leading edge of the turbine blades. 10 decimals though, Kara, to me, doesn't sound like much. Sounds a little disappointing. This sounds a little disappointing, actually. I could be wrong. I would expect more, but I don't think Steve would say, no, it's 11 decibels or even 100. let's see. The long-lasting oral drug. Sure, I could kind of buy that. The problem is 14 days, though, where you got to excrete that damn thing. How the hell is it hanging around? That's a problem. I'm not sure how that would be resolved, although I'm sure it's resolvable, but I can't quite imagine how they could do that. The number three, the non-rotating star. Yeah, I'm not buying that one either. Either it would be so far away that they would just say, yeah, there's no way we're going to detect any rotation on this, or they would just detect it. I don't think they're going to find one that they would really expect to detect some rotation and not find anything. The damn thing's got to rotate. It's not going to. It's not going to not rotate. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
Oh, I'm not.
So Kara's the outlier this week.
Oh, no.
You call Kara a liar?
All agree on number two, so we'll start there. Researchers have demonstrated an ultra-long-lasting oral drug delivery mechanism that can last for 14 days on a single dose. You all think this one is science, and this one is... Yeah. Science.
Yeah, baby.
All right. How are they doing?
Oh, I was kind of hoping we were all wrong.
Yeah, that would have been nice. But I just want to drag them down with you. I don't care.
Yeah.
But so here's the question. So how does that pill stay in the body for 14 days? So this is how it works. When it gets into the stomach, it unfolds into a shape that can't pass through the sphincter.
So it dissolves.
How does that not block food.
Right. Question. That's it. So it both keeps itself from passing through the sphincter, but doesn't block food from passing through the sphincter.
Ew. But it's like, becomes like a strainer.
I don't know what the.
Weird.
They didn't say what the shape was.
That doesn't sound safe to me for some reason.
It doesn't sound safe to me either.
How does it know it's in your sphincter?
What if it doesn't unfold?
Jay, it's okay. If it doesn't work, I mean, you just can't eat for 2 weeks and then you're good.
If it doesn't work, you just get a whole block.
It's a dietary problem.
So
then gotcha.
It breaks down over time. When, you know, it could be a week. It could be the test that they did lasted 2 weeks. Could even be longer. And then once it dissolves to a certain point, it then will break up and pass through your sphincter. And
all right, Steve, come on. As a doctor, what do you think about this?
It's awesome. Think about it. Think about somebody has an infection. They need a 10-day course of antibiotics. Here's one pill. You take it in the doctor's office. There's no issue of compliance, of stopping to take your medication. Right? Think about that. How awesome would that be?
Yeah, and there's no partial.
I'm worried about side effects still.
Yeah, well, I just don't like it that it partially blocks any part of my intestine that has to do with me eating.
Or what about the other side of that coin? What about having so much drug in your system at one time? If it decides to say screw it and just dissolve faster than you think, you'll poison yourself.
Well, they definitely have to perfect the slow release factor there.
That's got to be bulletproof. Yeah. That's got to be bulletproof.
So, you know, but there are downsides. Yeah, the downsides would be, what if you have a horrible side effect you don't like? Okay, well, you'll be over that and whatever.
That's right. They just can't stop taking the pill.
What if you have an allergic reaction to it? So it'd have to be a drug that we know you're not allergic to. Maybe you have to take a test dose. See, okay, no allergy,
sure.
No horrible side effects. Okay, now here's the 14-day version.
Well,
of
can't
it.
You just, but since it's in your stomach, can't you just, if you are allergic to it, induce vomiting?
Yeah, I guess so.
It'd be too big to if you're, puke up.
Would it come up?
Yeah, if it's already open, that's true. Then you might tear up your
esophagus.
That'd
be dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'd almost want to come up with something that is a secondary chemical that you can take induces.
Yeah,
that's
the antidote.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that would make it
drug causes cancer.
Oh, for sure.
Well, like I said, you don't want to dissolve it too fast, otherwise you're screwed. I think this one is cool but scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, so the idea is that, you know, we'd like to be able to have a drug that lasts for a long time on a single dose. But that magnifies not only the benefit, but also all the risks of it as well. And there are definitely some technological issues there.
Well, I have that with my birth control. That's why I love it so much.
Yeah, but that's
local.
It's local. Yeah, it's not oral.
Oral. It wouldn't work if it were oral. And there's transcutaneous. Dermal. Is that what they call it? Transdermal.
Transdermal.
Yeah, transdermal things that do that too, which is very cool.
That doesn't work for all drugs. Not all drugs are effective transdermally or whatever.
Or intravaginally. Yeah. What is this drug for?
This was an anti-malarial drug that they tested it on, which is, again, the idea is that you could give somebody a single dose and it treats their malaria.
Yeah. And in that case, it's like a risk-benefit thing too, right? Yeah. So the more severe the disease, the more you might be willing to put up with some of the risks.
Right. Right. Mm. Exactly. Okay, let's move on. I guess we'll go back to number one. By studying an owl's wing, engineers have designed an attachment that can reduce the noise generated by existing wind turbines by 10 decibels. Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science.
I retract.
This one is, have faith, Kara. This one is science.
Psych. Get for having faith.
Psych.
Thanks.
You should be confident even when you're wrong. Be absolutely confident.
No, I shouldn't be.
Our president is.
Okay. Bob, you're partially right. The owl's wings are very, very silent because of the anatomy on both the leading and trailing edge.
Interesting.
They both contribute to decreased turbulence or altering the turbulence of the air as it flows over the wing to reduce sound. Engineers at MIT were studying this to try to see if they can design the blades of whatever, a wind turbine or anything that air flows over, to try to reduce the noise. And they successfully came up with these, they 3D printed these attachments. They would be a wing attachment. And in their tests, they said it could decrease the sound generated by a wind turbine by 10 decibels. Kara, you are correct in that a decibel is a logarithmic scale. 10 decibels is a lot. This would be huge for wind turbines. There's a lot of sources on this, but I'm just going to quote one that's fairly representative. This is a specific wind turbine produced by GE, and they have a nice graphic showing the level of sound created by their one of their large, you know, megawatt turbines right at the source itself, it's 105 decibels, which is about as loud as a lawnmower. And then as you get farther away, the sound drops off. You know, within 100 meters, it drops down from 105 decibels down to about 50 decibels, which is like the size of an air conditioner. And then it tends to trail off. The sound carries. So then it doesn't continue to drop off quickly. It kind of levels off at around 40 decibels, which is about how loud your refrigerator is.
That's still pretty quiet, though, isn't
it? It's very quiet. That's the thing. You know, when we were talking about, I was writing about wind turbines recently. It's like, yeah, you know, once you get out to out 100 or 200 meters, the thing is as loud as your refrigerator. You know, it's not a big deal.
When you're going on your way to Palm Springs, you drive by this beautiful wind field in the middle of the desert. And I guess I've never rolled down my windows to try to listen, but I've never noticed any noise coming from it.
You'd have to be pretty close. Yeah. But a 10 decibel drop would still be significant, because then if you go down to 30 decibels, then you're well within any kind of noise ordinances. And it also means you can get a lot closer to it and still be below like the 40 to 45, which is usually where the cutoff is, where they say it's acceptable noise level for like a residence. So it would still be great. And the other great thing about this is that you could retrofit it to existing turbines.
Sure.
That would be awesome. Just slap these things on there.
Oh, wait. It's adding things onto the actual blades?
Well, hence the word attachment.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm sorry.
You should be.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Fantastic then. Yeah. So this is one of like still the NIMBY kind of objections to windmills is that they're noisy, even though they're really not. But still, knocking it down by 10 decibels really, really would be helpful in eliminating that as a barrier, as an obstacle to really, you know, utilizing wind turbines for clean energy production. There's still the bird killing issue, which I think we talked about recently. It's negligible, the number of birds that they kill. The only time I think, that it's a problem is if they put a lot of windmills where raptors will hunt or travel.
Kills the thermals or something?
Well, just because there's raptors, because they're a top predator, there's just not that many of them. So even if you're killing small numbers of them, it could still have a significant effect.
Yeah.
Plus, not a lot of cats are killing eagles. You know what I mean? But like, if you add up all the ways in which birds die, windmills is a round-off error. It's insignificant. But there's a couple of locations where they probably really need to move the turbines or replace them with fewer turbines. Like there's a couple of specific ones where there's a lot of old, not very efficient turbines, and they're right where raptors are flying at the wrong height and the wrong location. And now we've really figured out how to minimize the impact on birds by placement and other things. I really think it's a non-issue at this point, but still it gets cited as a reason not to put up wind turbines because it kills birds. It's like, okay, the windows kill literally thousands of times more birds than windmills. Okay, but this would be cool. All of this means that astronomers have discovered for the first time a star that is not detectably rotating is the fiction, because you guys are all correct. All
Except
stars
me.
Rotate.
But you did say it was really slow.
Yeah, but but we did discover the roundest star that to ever be measured. And that is a direct result of it spinning very slowly, but it's still very much spinning. So this is a star, Kepler-1114-5123, which we measured the diameter around the equator and around the polar axis. And there is only a 3 kilometer difference between the two, which makes it the roundest object in the universe that we have measured. And that is a function of the fact that it's rotating very slowly. So our sun rotates with a period of 27 days.
I didn't know that. Is that like a well-known thing? Or is that kind of like
trivia?
For a while.
It's kind of trivia, but I think people know roughly. If you're interested in astronomy, you probably have a rough idea of how fast the sun is rotating.
27 days.
All the planets. You have to know what your planets are rotating.
The difference between the polar and equatorial diameters for our sun is 21 kilometers, and this one is 3 kilometers. So that doesn't sound dramatic. You know, it's like not even in order of magnitude, but it still makes it the roundest object that we've ever measured. It's also bigger. It's also bigger. Yeah, it's a bigger star.
Yeah, it's like twice the size.
The roundest celestial object.
Yeah, I checked, Kara. You are correct. The that silicon sphere that the Australians made varies in a ratio of 3 out of 12.5 million, and this is a ratio of 3 out of 1.5 million. So the silicon sphere is rounder. So it's 3 kilometers out of 1.5 million kilometers. That's how.
Yeah, that's
round it is.
Yeah, that's.
That's pretty damn round.
But it is rotating. Yeah. So we haven't. Yeah. And because as stars collapse, the conservation of angular momentum, they have to rotate. So it still leaves the question for this star, which is rotating very slowly. How could it be rotating so slowly? Why isn't it rotating faster like most stars?
Yeah, but didn't they speculate magnetic fields could be masking some of the rotation?
That's true. That's one speculation. They also speculate that it might have collided with something that canceled out.
Yes.
Yeah. So after it collapsed down and it was rotating, then and something hit it and slowed it down in such a way to slow it down. That's why it's not that it's things don't have to rotate. It's not like it's impossible. It's just really unlikely that something would happen that exactly canceled out its angular momentum. It's just statistically extremely unlikely. But when you think about it, there's billions of stars out there, you know, so even something that's really unlikely, we may eventually find, you know, I wonder what the slowest rotating star in the universe is, you know, think about that of the quadrillions or whatever of stars in the universe. What's the slowest one?
There's got to be a bunch that have no detectable rotation at all.
It's not impossible. Sure.
Yeah. Based on the sheer numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Given enough opportunities,
it's almost guaranteed.
Even very, very, one in a 10 trillion thing will happen. You know, if you have
it, would be peculiar if there was not these very slowly rotating objects.
But we haven't found one yet. This is the closest one so far. Pretty cool.
Very cool.
All right. Good job, boys. Kara, you know, this is a tough one.
It's been a while since I was on this side of the fence, so I'll take comfort in that.
Yeah, you guys are taking your turn, turns being the outlier who's getting it wrong. Yeah.
You always get me with the space stuff, though.
Yeah. I try not to have too many of them. Kara, you have to listen to some astronomy courses at the Great Courses.
Yes. I should do that.
You should.
Listen to more astronomy at the Great Courses Plus.
All right, Evan, you have a quote for us this week?
I do. They say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, but it's not one half so bad as a lot of ignorance. Very well said. Very well said. Terry Pratchett. Sir Terence David John Terry Pratchett. English author of fantasy novels, especially comical works, best known for his Discworld series. 41 novels.
Have you ever read any of those?
No. Have you?
Yeah, I read a couple of them. They're good.
And?
Yeah, they're good.
Good.
Yeah.
More than 85 million books sold worldwide.
That's
37
nice.
Languages. Wow. The best-selling UK's best-selling author in the 1990s.
Really? Even better than Harry Potter?
Harry Potter's in the 2000s, I think. In any case. Plus, there have been... I've read several... People have submitted several quotes from Terry Pratchett. Haven't gotten around to using one yet. I'd like this one. Decided to use it tonight. So he was a critical thinker. As well, clearly.
1997, by the way, was the first Harry Potter book published.
Ah, Terry Pratchett. Gone in 2015, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. He was diagnosed in 2007 with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
That's terrible.
So, you know, very, very sad. And he's gone at age 66, still very young.
Too young. We also lost another somebody else very, very young this week, Gwen Ifill. You guys know who that is. She's
That's so
right.
Reporter for NPR. Yeah. Shocking. I was like, wow. You know, I haven't heard the story. Did you hear the story of why she died so young, Kara?
I know she had cancer, right? But she just didn't tell anyone.
Okay, that's why it was this.
Yeah, surprise. It was just like a private battle with it.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Cancer and Alzheimer's disease. We always like to end our shows on an up note. Yeah.
Next week, I'll come up with a quote from someone who is still alive and kicking.
All right,
that would be helpful.
Or long dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Of something fascinating, some sort of fascinating disease. Pick one of them.
Right. Maybe someone who was poisoned. Maybe. Ooh. We'll see. Ooh, intrigue.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely.
Thanks, Steve.
You got it, brother.
Next week will be our Thanksgiving episode.
Uh-oh, Jay.
Yeah. Jay's- yeah, that's, are you going to give me another free win over here or what, Steve?
We'll see. We'll see. We've already covered Thanksgiving for science fiction.
Steve, here's what you do. Canada has their own version of Thanksgiving. Do
make Canadian Thanksgiving.
Canadian Thanksgiving.
Well, I can't now that you just said it. But.
Oh, crap.
Or can he?
So I'm definitely not going to cover that. Definitely. So don't bother with that one.
Don't even bother looking anything up for
or
that.
Or can he?
So we'll talk to you guys all next week. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.